So how's that for inside information? But now the axioms. The axioms of people who've been coming to classes for years have been two things. One, it somehow always gets back to the Garden of Eden. And it's not, I don't believe it's going to do that today. I really don't, but I never know where it's going because I didn't hear the class yet. The second thing is that Yosef always wins. And that's going to be true today as well. Yosef, so maybe we'll start all over again now. The book of Bereshit is a trilogy. There are three parts to the book. The first part is everything before Avram Avinu. All of that we can call prehistory. Tohu v'vohu, the way Chazal calls it. This is before Avraham, preparation, not ready for prime time, okay? Then we get to the Avod and the Imahot, and the truth is you can then tell me, well, that should take us all the way to the end of the book, but it doesn't. It only takes us until, I think, the beginning of this week's Parsha. And you could have argued about last week a little bit, but really what's the change between this week till the end versus the last couple of weeks? And that is that Avraham at this point is really, sorry, Yaakov at this point is really not the main character. He's an important character, but he's a side point. It's moved. And we'll see the exact verse where it moves in a moment, but it's moved. And from here to the end of the book, it's about the next generation. There's actually a race, there's a competition going on, which it was never stated as a competition, but there is a competition. And the competition is going to be who's going to win, and at... You know that Yosef is one of the protagonists. The question is, who's the other protagonist? That's right ultimately, but it's not right initially. Okay, so Yehuda eventually will become the surprise, actually the surprise candidate, because there was no reason to bet on Yehuda. Actually, there was every reason not to bet on Yehuda. But the real other protagonist we'll get to in a moment, and we'll leave this for you to contemplate and therefore ignore everything I'm going to say right now as you're thinking about it. Vayeshev Yaakov be'eretz Migroyoviv be'eretz Kanan. Yaakov settled in the land where his father, and the word Migurei is interesting, because there's a contrast. Vayeshev Yaakov be'eretz, I know, but Migurei is not the same root as Vayeshev.
Right.
So but Vayeshev and Migurei is different. And it seems to be, and this is where Rashi's coming from. Rashi's not on this Pasuk. Rashi's on Pasuk Bet. Rashi, it's not here. Rashi there says, Bikish Yaakov l'shev b'shalva. Yaakov wanted peace and tranquility. So where does he get that from? So apparently it's the contrast between Vayeshev versus Migurei. Word Migurei has at its core to be a stranger, to be different, which means Avraham is a stranger in the land. And maybe one of the strongest points when he wants to bury his wife, he doesn't have a place to bury her. It's his land. God promised him this land. But that's just a promise. I'm not saying God's promise isn't good. God is good for the promise. But at this point, it's just, it's a future. It's not reality. It's not the present. For Yitzchak as well. It's his land, except people abuse him in the land. He gets his wells filled up and so on and so forth. So as much as I can say that Avraham and Yitzchak own this land, it is their land, it's not their land. And therefore... Most likely, the pshat in the Brit Bein Abtarim, Vayomer LaAvram Yodea Teda. One of the other things they do to try to make sure we can't understand Chumash is they don't teach men and they do teach women, but they teach men trup and they don't teach the women the trup. So therefore, the men have part of the skills to learn, but they never learn, and then the women don't have the skills to learn because how can you read a pasuk if you don't know the trup? But if you're a woman, you say, I want to learn the trup, they'll say, oh my God, you know, what's that could end the world. Or worse, because who knows where that can lead. Stop with the mixed dancing. Do you know this thing about it could lead to this mixed dancing is actually a Mishnah Berurah quoting a Rav Akiva Eiger? Yes. It's a thing. It's a real thing. It's a real thing. It's talking about dancing. It's talking about dancing and celebrating too much during Yom Tovim, and how you have to appoint a tznius patrol to make sure that people don't get crazy because dancing could lead to mixed dancing. As I said, it's actually Rakiv Eger quoting somebody else. If you want, I will provide the sources. Anyway, so let me read the verse now. Okay, again. I'm reading, you don't have it in front of you, Perek Tet Vav Pasuk Yud Yomer. Vayomer LaAvram Yodea Teda Ki Geri Yezaracha Be'eretz Lo Lahem va'avadum ve'inu otam. So there's a thing called an atnachta underneath the otam. That means that's where you pause, that's the first half of the pasuk. The rest of the pasuk reads, arba ma'ot shana, 400 years. So the wrong way to read this pasuk, don't be too upset with me, because there are some places among Chazal who read it wrong. Please don't get upset with what I said, because you're allowed to read a verse and distill all kinds of things from it, but nonetheless, we still need to know what pshat is. Because the etnachta is where it is, the arbama od shana goes on the whole first part of the verse, not on the last clause before it. The wrong way to read it is, you should know, your children will be strangers in a land which isn't theirs, and will be abused, will be enslaved and abused, and then 400 years. But there's an etnachta. So the 400 years goes on the whole first part as well, which means they will be in a land which isn't theirs for 400 years, not that the slavery is going to take place for 400 years. I know that the whole argument, no, it says 400 years, it doesn't. It says they will, again, different elements here. They will be strangers in a land which is not theirs for 400 years. Within those 400 years, some of those years, they will be enslaved and abused. But there's three different elements: strangers, slaved, and abused. The 400 years goes on all of them. So when Chazal tell us, oh, when did we start counting? We start counting from the birth of Yitzchak. Of course you start counting from the birth of Yitzchak, because that's when they first had children. Zar'acha, your descendants will be enslaved. When does he have descendants? When he has a child. That's the point to start counting. Was Yitzchak in a land which wasn't his? Of course he was in a land which wasn't his. What was the land which wasn't his? Eretz Canaan. Eretz Migurei Aviv. Ger Yeh Zaracha. Yitzchak and Yaakov lived in a land which wasn't his. But Yaakov decides, no. Yaakov decides, this is my land. And here I have to pause again. There's a couple of things that happened, and we're going to get to them, and hopefully we'll get to everything I want to talk about. Rav Soloveitchik used to give a shiur on Parsha. So here's the backstory. His wife died in 1967, and he was functional pretty much till 1985, 86. He used to give shiurim. From 1967 onwards, he had people who would help him, who would, young yeshiva guys who would come to the apartment, they would buy his food, and they would set up his appointments, and they would hang around. And that was the place to hang out. You hang out in the Rav's apartment, where, right? What would be better than that? He actually had cable television. That's another story for another time. Not for now. Not for now. But one day, he looks up at the Ferries guys who were hanging out one evening. He goes, what are you guys doing here? And he says, Rebbe, we're here to help you. He goes, why aren't you married and with your own families? Like, why are you staying here with an old man? Like, what's the matter with you people? So one of them said, listen, it's not so easy. These guys are already in their mid-upper 20s. And he goes, it's not so easy. You know, we're not the kind of guys who are going to hang out in front of Stern or hang out in the lobby in Stern and just, you know, whistle at the girls going by. It's not. On the other hand, we're not the kind of guys who go on Shiduchim. This is modern orthodoxy in the late 70s or so. We don't go on Shiduchim, so we're basically stuck. So Rav said like this, announce that I'm going to give a shiur on Wednesday night in Chumash, in Parsha Shavua. It's open for everybody, men, women, and whatever. And he said to them, I'll get the girls in the room, but you got to go over and talk to them. That's the true story of his Parsha shiur. He said, I'll hook you up. This is a, you never heard this? He goes, I'll get the girls in the room. So he did. It worked. I don't know how many shidduchim came out of this, but that was the objective of it. It wasn't to teach chumash. That was the objective. I have no idea what the objective of this is here today, but that was the objective of the Rav. The last shir I heard him give in chumash till he got sick, and then he started cutting part of his schedule, and that was one of the things that got cut. The last year, he said the following. He said that Bikish Yaakov L'Shevet B'Shalva means that Yaakov believed that the 400 years was up. Now, hold it. 400 years couldn't have been up. It wasn't 400 years. But the Pasuk by the Bris Ben Absurm continues and says, V'dor Revi, the fourth generation, is going to be able to come back. So Yaakov then looks, and this is part of the difficulty of looking at prophecies and deciding that you understand them. Yaakov says, four generations. Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov, Bnei Yaakov, four generations. You'll be abused and enslaved in a land which wasn't yours. Oh, Lavan was a really bad guy. That was a really bad slavery. You're going to leave Beruchosh Gadol. Well, look at all the stuff I left with. And then Yaakov comes back and says, okay, this must be the Messianic age. And God, and that's the what Rashi says. No, Kovtzo Alav Rogzo Shel Yosef. There's a whole nother episode, and Jewish history is not at the end yet. There's going to be so much blood spilled and so many tears and so many more episodes that you think that you know exactly what's going on. Sometimes reading prophecies, even it's black and white in the prophets, sometimes that doesn't always work. So that's the other thing about reading prophecies, is that there is definitely a possibility that there are windows of opportunity where things could happen or maybe even should happen, but whether they do happen or not, that will depend on other criteria. So now let's continue. Going back to the beginning of Vayeshev, we got past the first pasuk, and that was good. I'm very hopeful for today. Vayeshev Yaakov ve'eretz mugurei aviv ve'eretz Kanaan. So Yaakov settles in this place where his father and grandfather were strangers. And then Pasuk Bet is really a difficult Pasuk. Eilat, I'm going to read it through, and then we're going to go back again. Eilat toldot Yaakov, Yosef ben Shavasre Shana, Hayaro et Echav Betzon, Vuhunar b'nei Bilo b'nei Zilpa, Nishay Aviv, Veyvei Yosef et Ibatam, Ra el Avihem. Do you realize how rich that Pasuk is? And it actually should have been at least three different Pasukim. And it should have had more words and it should have had less words. So enough of my editorial comments. Eila toldot Yaakov then should say Reuven. Eila toldot Yaakov should say Reuven. It should say Reuven and then it say Shimon and Levi and so on. And even if you want to start with Yosef, it should say Yosef ben Yamin. And then it should say Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, Zebulun, and so on. Eila toldot Yaakov. So Eila toldot Yaakov then gets truncated and we stop after only one. And that's very interesting. Does that mean that Yaakov really believes that his only true son is Yosef? And that's the only son he ever wanted? And everything else was pretty much an accident and unintended and not part of the dream and not part of his family? I don't think that's the answer, but Eila told it Yaakov, Yosef ben Shvasre Shana, Hayaroa et Echav Batzon. And there's something wrong about that phrase. Because Roe is a shepherd, so you shepherd your flock, you don't shepherd your brothers. So right there we have a problem, and the problem is, okay, Eila toldot Yaakov Yosef, Eila toldot Yaakov Yosef ben Shvasre Shana. So Yosef is 17 years old. And I think the way that we like to read this is that there's this profound immaturity in Yosef, and the reason we say that is because of the next phrase. So let's read the next phrase and try to understand what that says, but we still have open problems. V'hu na'ar. Now, Rashi, as some of you remember, explains v'hu na'ar independently as if it were an independent statement. V'hu na'ar, he was very immature. He would look in the mirror and he would fix his hair and so on and so forth. But it's not what it says. Again, if you want to use the revi on top of the nun of the nar, vahunar. So therefore, you can say there's a pause there, but it's again, it doesn't say vahunar. It says vahunar et b'nei bilha b'nei zilpa. So there is something else going on in what he's doing in terms of the b'nei bilha b'nei zilpa, nishay aviv. And then it says, vayove Yosef adibatam rel aviyam. And then Yosef tattles on them, and he tells about all their bad things. Now the question is over here, a very simple question. What is this pasuk trying to convey? And essentially what I'm doing is I'm giving up on the details because there's too many details here. Of course, we have to use the details. But I'm giving up on the details and I'm just saying, can you please tell me the big picture what this pasuk just now said? Was this a positive thing? Was this a negative thing? Did Yosef do good things just now? Did Yosef do bad things? And obviously, if I'm asking this question, there's two different possible answers. One possible answer is that, oh, this is really bad. And the other possibility is this is really good. And the other possibility is a combination of them. You could have good intentions and bad consequences. I guess you can have bad intentions and good consequences, but it's not simple. What I will point out is Yaakov approving of this. And the answer is obviously. Why would I say obviously? Because later on, after this whole section of dreams, what do we learn? We learn that the rest of the brothers had gone off to do what they do, and what is that? They're shepherding. Where do we see that? Pasuk Yud Bet, V'yelchu Echov lerot et tzon aviyem b'Shechem. And they go to Shechem. Now, of course, we have to pause a second because Shechem is a trigger. Yes? Not in the sense I can't say anything about it. Of course, I'll say something about it. But Shechem is a trigger because Shechem is important. And hold on. Also, is Shechem a good place or a bad place? I ask my same question again, but hold on to this. Vayomer Yisrael el Yosef, lo achecha ro'im b'Shechem, l'cho v'eshlechecha lehim, vayomer lo hineni, vayomer lo lechna re'e et shlom achecha v'et shlom atzon v'ashivenu davar. So, the brothers are shepherds, and Yosef is sent to shepherd the brothers. Yosef is told to go and to look after how the brothers are doing, and then he's told them, bring me back a report. So as far as the elements in this first pasuk, Yosef shepherds the brothers, but he doesn't shepherd the flocks. Yosef is different from the others. He has a different status. Elo told it to Yaakov, Yosef. Yosef has a different status than the others. The others are shepherds. Yosef's not a shepherd. The others take care of the flock. Yosef looks after his brothers. Yosef tells about his brothers, and his father asks him to tell about his brothers. So again, when I read this pasuk over here, and I say, oh, look at this terrible things that Yosef have done, I just want to point out that everything that we think, at least maybe, I'm afraid to say everything, but, and I said the big picture, the things that Yosef did, which we could attack him for, oh, how did you treat your brothers like that, and what are you doing? It all came with parental approval and instruction. This is what Yaakov asks him to do. This is Yaakov and Yosef being the extension of Yaakov. And that really leads you to read the pasuk a little differently. Elo told it Yaakov, Yosef. The extension of Yaakov is Yosef. Does that mean there are no other brothers? No, quite the opposite. There are other brothers, but there's only one who's an extension of the father. And there's another way of saying that. The other way of saying the extension of the father is saying that Yosef has already been chosen as the Bechor. He's the firstborn. But of course, you can argue he's not the firstborn, but he is the firstborn because he was always supposed to be the firstborn. He's always supposed to be the firstborn because Rachel was supposed to be the only wife. So Ela told it Yaakov Yosef doesn't reject the existence of all the other brothers, but what it does do is it changes the status of Yosef versus the other brothers. So that's, I think, should help us a little bit in terms of reading this. Now, let's just think about Shechem for a second. And then we're going to go backwards a little bit and see how much more we can work into this. Source number two is a Gemara. Various Midrashim say the same thing. Vehiba hetahiva yaravam yatsam yushalayim. Tanu mishum Rabbi Yosi. So this is one of my around 800 examples where the biblical character who is going to be spoken about has the same name as the Tana or the Amora who's doing the speaking. Tana Mishum Rabbi Yosi, Eit Himuzmunenet Le Paranut. At this time, Yeravam did this. This was a bad time. Vayihibe Eitahiva Yered Yehuda, and he also sees a similar, and at that time, it's also a bad time. Tana Mishum Rabbi Yosi, Eit Himuzmunenet Le Paranut, and that's also a bad time. Vayelech Rechavam Shechem, Ki Shechem Bo Kol Yisrael Am Lichoto, Tana Mishum Rabbi Yosi, Mokom Mizuman Le Paranut. Shechem is a bad place. Bishchem Inu Et Dina, in Shechem Dina was abused. B'shchem machruat achivat Yosef. In Shechem, Yosef was sold. B'shchem nechlecha malchut Beit David. And in Shechem, the malchut of Beit David fell apart. So there's a lot to say about Shechem and lots to say about this, and especially Mechirat Yosef, which didn't really take place in Shechem. It took place in Dotan. It was in Shechem. It was Jenin, and Jenin's not a nice place either. But when we hear Shechem, that right away should say, hold it. You know, this is not a great place. On the other hand, source number three, we learn, this is right after Lech Lecha. V'yikach Avram et Sarai Yishto, v'et Lot ben Achiv, v'et Koruch Hashem Asher Rechashu, v'et Nefesh Asher Asubar Haran, v'yitzu Lechet Aretz Kanan, v'yavo Eretz Kanan. They go and they follow God's instruction to go to the place that I'll tell you. Where do they go? To the Eretz Kanan. Where does Avram go first in Eretz Kanan? Where does he pitch his first tent? V'yavor Avram ba'aretz ad makom Shechem. And Avram goes to Shechem. Shechem is the first place when he crosses over the river. That's where he pitches his tent. Ad Elon Morev Aknani Az Ba'aretz. And what is the response of God when Avram reaches Shechem? Ve'yera Hashem al Avram. And there God appears to him. Ve'yom el Zarecha Tena Ta'aretz Hazot. You got to the right place. So Shechem is not just a negative place. Shechem is the place that Avram pitches his tent. Shechem is the place that God speaks to him. And Shechem is the place that God confirms, this is the land of Israel. This is Israel. You are here. In source number 4, we're not going to read the whole Ramban, but here is where the Ramban begins to spell out for us his whole theory of Maasei Avot Siman Labanim, which is based on a Medrash Tanchuma. And towards the end of this, he talks about Shechem, 4 lines from the bottom in the Ramban in source 4, he Shechem, unless it's 5 lines, ki zeh shem makom ahu, v'shechem ben chamor, so how does it get the name? And he quotes Rashi, v'nachon hu, the end of the line, v'ani mosif, this is the first place that Avraham pitched his tent. What's the significance? Well, the Ramban is telling us about Maasei Avot Siman Labanim, that the acts of the fathers have some kind of incredibly profound impact on the future. Avraham pitched his tent before God even gave him the land. That this is an indication that Avram pitched his tent before God gave him this land. The children will capture this land before the time is up. At which time, either the 400 years or the 2 or the 4 generations before the Avon of Emory. Hold it. Where do they capture the land? The Kodmaito Avon Yosheva Aretz Shalem. Again, it's the Avon Emory referenced in the Brit Bein Abitarim. And that's why it says, right, the Knani are still there. So what is he referring to? He's referring to the children of Yaakov, Shimon and Levi, going to war and capturing Shechem. Now that's very interesting, because some of you would have said, well, that, first of all, that was an outrage. Secondly, the Ramban thinks it's an outrage. And nonetheless, the Ramban sees within this outrage something happened, and what happened is this was the first military battle in the land of Israel, and the first battle that took place was Shechem, and we captured Shechem. Again, you don't bother me with any kinds of moral qualms right now, of no interest. Yes, he bought the areas around Shechem, right? I agree completely. Yaakov buys Shechem, which is most likely the reason why they choose that place to go with the flocks. But more than that, what the Ramban is pointing out is that here we had a successful military conquest, and the first one takes place in Shechem. Yeah, but if he wants to read this into the Ramban, I don't believe he's correct. So let's then continue. Yeah.
Isn't Shechem also where we have the brachot and the kalot?
Yes, yes. Shechem is the place that Am Yisrael also come in for. Meaning, Shechem is not just... meaning, the Gemara just now gave us all these negative things, but I'm pointing out there's 2 sides of Shechem. The other thing that he referenced here was source number 5, and this is where Shimon and Levi, they hear about what happened in Shechem. Vayanu b'nei Yaakov et Shechem v'et Chamor avim b'mirma. Over here, the Unkelus writes, b'chochma, with wisdom, and they went, and they, why? Asher timei dina achotam. They hear, they understand, they feel, this is visceral, that their sister had been violated. And at the very end, when Yaakov complains, how can you do this? They write, so there's something over here that I think is very important for us to hear. And with this, hopefully we'll be able to go back. Shimon and Levi understand that something really bad happened by Shechem. And what is it? That their sister was violated. But what are they doing? They are protecting their sister's honor, and they are defending their sister. And Yaakov doesn't attack them for that. Yaakov attacks them for the way that they did it. But I think we could distinguish between 2 different things. Shimon and Levi, they have their sister's back, and they're not going to let go of her. This is their sister. And that's what comes out of the text. That's why I emphasized, Edina Achutam. And one of the things that maybe what we should be getting out of today's shiur in terms of methodology is always pay attention to how relationships are stated. Because how relationships are stated will reveal to us another level of what's really going on. Over here, their outrage is not because a Jewish girl, no. It's their sister. And at the very end, Hachazonu Yaset Achutenu, this is our sister. And I think this point is so strong that it actually leads to a second point. And it's a question that I don't believe I've ever seen anybody ask, because you need to be a little twisted to ask this. And that question is, So where was Reuven and where were Yehuda? I'm not going to blame Yisachar and Zvulun, they're a little bit younger still. Why aren't Reuven and Yehuda with them on this, joining them in the mission? So you can say, what's the matter with you? Shimon and Levi did something wrong. But no, they did something wrong, but they decided they have to defend their sister. Why is it Reuven there and why is it Yehuda there? Now, I think this question is better than any of you are going to allow, because I think that there are answers to this. So let's, and obviously you know that this is one of these tricks of rabbis. We never ask questions unless we have an answer to it. But I think that there's something more to this, and this we need to pay attention. So let's go back again. Let's wait. So let's then go back. And how do we read Pasuk Bet? Because Yosef does something. Hunar et b'nei Bilhah b'nei Zilpah nishei aviv. Yosef in Pasuk Bet in source 1 does something to b'nei Bilhah and b'nei Zilpah. And essentially there are two very different ways of reading this. One is he treats them inappropriately, and two, he treats them appropriately. And by the way, treating them appropriately could also include the very next clause, telling their father when they do something wrong, because that's what their father wants. But I guess really the question over here is going to be a deeper question. And that is, how does Yosef see, let's start with B'nai Bilhah, how does Yosef see the children of Bilhah? The reason why I pose the question is because who's Bilhah? Bilhah is a servant of Rachel. She's the maidservant of Rachel. She does Rachel's bidding, including incredibly personal tasks that she's asked to fulfill. So there was a possibility, or there is a possibility, that Yosef's way that he would look at Bilhah, on the one hand, and therefore by extension B'nai Bilhah, or essentially as Bilhah is his slave, because it was his mother's slave, and B'nai Bilhah are also his slaves. These are the children of slaves, which means if I were to take this whole scene and move it down to a plantation in the 1840s and have the mother's servant and then the mother's servant's children, so then how do I look at these children? Which, again, I'm just saying this as a possibility that Yosef could have looked at all these people as being unequals, right? These people are children of a Pilegesh, of Pilagshim. Now, Rashi doesn't read it that way. Rashi reads it quite the opposite, that there was an attack against them, and Yosef is the one who counters the attack. The Rashi is in... hopefully, look at source 22. V'hu na'ar. So here Rashi parses the verse in a strange way. He divides the na'ar from everything else. He says, V'hu na'ar she'a osa ma'asei na'arut, mitaken besaro u'mashmesh be'inav k'dei she'a nira yafeh. Et b'nei bilha, but it didn't say that. It says, V'hu na'ar et b'nei bilha. And here Rashi, as I said, he separates and says, Klo mev'ragil etzel b'nei bilha. He used to hang out with them. Actually, Rashi again parsed it in a funny way because it didn't just say B'nai Bilhah, it said B'nai Bilhah, B'nai Zilpah. So Rashi's just doing some very funny things on this verse. And then he writes, Klomar, Ragilets B'nai Bilhah, Lefi Shahoyu Echav Mivazin Otan Vuhu Mikarvan. Because the brothers are humiliating them, and he is bringing them close to him, which means Rashi reads, "Behunar b'nei Bilhah b'nei Zilpah." Again, the argument is easier by Bilhah. Huh? He's saying he's bringing close. Later on, when Yosef is going to have the dream and the sun and the moon, which represented his mother, Yaakov says, "What are you talking about? Your mother's dead. How will your mother bow down to you?" Aside from all the other problems of the dream, and Rashi there also states that Yaakov didn't realize that Yosef was referring to Bilhah, who he saw as a mother. Which means later, the dream's important. The dream's important because it tells us also about the relationship. Rachel dies when Yosef is probably around 10 years old. I'm more or less. Binyamin is born. Rachel dies in childbirth. Who took that baby? Who picked up that baby? Who put the baby? Who had the crib next to her bed at night? Who perhaps nursed that baby? I'm saying, who takes care of Binyamin? And the answer obviously should be Bilha, because Bilha is the one who is the servant of Rachel, and she's the one who is going to have some kind of a deeper connection than anyone else to this child. Now, that actually is going to give us a little bit of information for something else that has happened previously, and then hopefully everything will begin to fall into place, which means Yosef sees Bilha as his mother, and he sees B'nai Bilha as his brothers. Now, where does Yosef get that from? So that's why we need to go back and look at this other episode, which actually the big advantage, if you went to yeshiva, then practically all the things we're going to learn today were all skipped. Right? All new material. In source number 8, Bishkon Yisrael Ba'aretzahi, Ba'aretzahi, Vayelech Ruvin Vayishkavet Bilha Pilegish Aviv, Vayishma Yisrael, Vayu B'nei Yaakov, Shnei Masar. So you should notice a whole bunch of things in this verse. One thing you should notice is the double usage of Yisrael in the first clause, V'yim b'shkon Yisrael b'aretzahi. Again, there is this accent, there is this settling in the land, the fact that Yisrael feels comfortable in this land. This is after the name was changed the second time. V'yishma Yisrael, Yisrael heard. And then, V'yu b'nei Yaakov shnei masar. So let's go back to what Reuven actually did. So there's a machloket. The Gemara mentions this point, Kol mi she'omer she'Reuven chata, einu elatoa, whoever says that Reuven sinned is mistaken. So apparently among the people mistaken are Yaakov Avinu, because later on in Parashat Vayechi, he says, you climbed on my bed. Look in source number 9, Reuven b'chori ata kochiv reshit oni, yeter se'et v'yeter oz, pachas kemayim, you're unstable as water, al totar, you will not lead, ki alita mishkavei avicha, because you climbed on your father's bed. Which means it's, Yaakov could have, if he was upset, he could have said, you got involved in interior decorating. Whoever asked you, right, to be moving around the beds, that was not your job. And that's the way that it's read, but that's not what Yaakov says. Yaakov, so kol ha'omer, so apparently Yaakov is toeh. But let's be a little bit clearer. Pshat in the pasuk is that Reuven sleeps with Bilha. Now the only question is why, and there's multiple possibilities. One possibility is that this is simply an act of lust. That's it. I don't have to go any further than that, and I'm willing to say that, except for a bunch of other words in this verse. You know, in the next couple of chapters, we're going to have other acts that need to be compared to this. You have the act of lust of Shechem. You're going to have Yehuda and Tamar, which also, if chapter 38 is in your Chumashim. And afterwards you have Yosef and Eshet Potiphar, which means you have a number of sections that all should be compared one to the other. With Yehuda and... See, Yehuda's a whole... It starts actually a whole nother problem. With Yehuda, which is on source 23, Vayarshem Yehuda bat ish Kna'ani. Yehuda marries into a Canaanite family. Should that set off any red lights for anybody? Source 23 on page 3. The fact that he marries into a Canaanite family, should that be troubling for anyone? Yeah. Of course it should be troubling, because that's one of the things we were told not to do. That was one of these things that Yaakov is sent away and find a wife, he gets some other place, and Yehuda marries a Canaanite, which is actually, if we wouldn't be nice, but we're nice, you would say, hold it, who's the last guy to marry a Canaanite? What's that guy's name? Oh, Esav. Yeah, Esav. Which is very interesting. See, we tend to read the Chumash the way that Chazal does, which almost has, and excuse the phraseology, almost a comic book type of, there's good guys and there are bad guys, and the good guys are very good and the bad guys are very bad. And I challenge you on a pshat level to show me how Yishmael or Esav ever did anything as bad as Reuven or Shimon or Levi or Yehuda for that matter. Because on a pshat level, what does Yitzchak, Yishmael, what does Yishmael do? He laughs. So, laughs has a connotation of Gilui Arayot. You know what? Climbing into bed with Bilhah also has a connotation of Gilui Arayot. Right? Shimon and Levi, well, you have a connotation over there of Shvichas Damim, of murder. Right before this, we also, right after that actually, we have this plea from Yaakov, get rid of all the Avodah Zarah that you've collected along the way. And that Avodah Zarah could have been from Shechem, it could have been back from Lavan's house. So we basically have the children of Yaakov guilty at this point of Gilui Arayot, Shvichas Damim, and Avodah Zarah, but we're the good guys. Okay, so again, Esav, okay, that's terrible, because he marries a Canaanite, okay, but at least none of the Shvatim did, except for, well, yeah. So Yehuda has a bad day, and he marries this Canaanite woman, and then we get very surprised when his children don't behave properly. And one child does something, and he dies. And right then, I know that I skipped part of the story. I skipped the whole Mechirat Yosef. But one of the children does something wrong and he dies. If you're Yehuda, you should absolutely have seen this as a sign from heaven. You led your father to believe that he lost a child, and now you lost a child. How in the world, now you know what that pain feels like. How in the world can you just ignore this and not go back to your father and say, you know what? Yosef may not be dead, and I will go and find him. I mean, show leadership, show responsibility. By the way, if the Torah was actually written by Jews, there's no way you leave this like this. It's such cruelty. It's even worse than the Mechirat Yosef before, because now there's and then the second child dies. So where's this? You know, sometimes God's speaking to you. I didn't hear you, and he has the opposite conclusion. It must be her, something wrong with her. And he says, just wait, you'll wait. So she has these years of loneliness. And then what happens? Then his wife dies. Oh, that's really bad. He needs to find companionship. So I'm saying, you're looking at Yehuda over here. He's missing every single sign. And it's almost like there's no religious, there's identity over here whatsoever. And the other thing which is interesting is when the first son dies, he tells the second son, now marry and take responsibility and keep your brother's name alive. And he doesn't want to because he knows the child will be his brother's. Where is the sense of brotherhood? Didn't Yehuda ever say you need to look after one another? So when I asked the question before, so where was Yehuda when it came to defend the reputation of Dinah, when it came to save Dinah? Why doesn't he care about his sibling? So we see that Yehuda doesn't do a very good job of passing on sibling responsibility to his children as well. So therefore, I'm saying there is this bit of a condemnation here against Yehuda. On the other hand, when we look at Yosef, and Yosef is being hit upon by Eshet Potiphar, so Yosef is also, he's young, and how do you want to put this? Raging hormones, and what other excuses we want to give. The best decision Yosef could have done was absolutely to be with this woman, but he doesn't. And he actually gives two different reasons. One, it will be a slap in the face and indecent to this man who took me into this house. There's a lack of decency over here. The second, he says it will be a sin against God. So with Yosef, again, absolutely compare Yosef and Potiphar with Yehuda and Tamar, and Yosef wins and Yehuda loses. And Yosef has a sense of decency, and Yehuda doesn't. And let's go back to Reuven now, because I want to ask the same question about Reuven. I already asked the question. First of all, I asked, so what about Reuven? Why wasn't he there with Shimon and Levi? Well, Reuven may have other considerations. When it says that Reuven goes and he's with Bilhah, I asked, is this simply a question of lust? And if it is she the only available woman in all of Canaan that he can hit on? Or is there something else going on? So now pay attention to the language which is being used, because the language which is being used, which I've already given you all the hints here, will tell us and provide the answer to the question. Over here it says that who does he sleep with? Vayishkav et Bilha Pilegish Aviv. He sleeps with Bilha, the Pilegish of his father. When it talks about Yosef and his relationship with B'nai Bil and B'nai Zilpa, what word did it use there? Nishay Aviv. The wives. Same women or different women? Same Bilha? Or there are two different Bilhas? Anybody want a two different Bilha theory? No, it's the same Bilha. But what's the difference between the two? Reuven sees Bilha as Pilegish Aviv. He sees her as something, or something, not someone, something which is owned by his father. It's property. Reuven is the one who's making the claim that Bilha and Zilpa are property. They're not wives, they're property. And what happens with property? It gets passed on. And he's making a claim over here on taking over, on inheriting his father. He's saying that my father's property will one day be my property, and I'm the firstborn, and therefore I can take what I want. Something that we find later on in the Navi as well, Adoniyahu, we find Avshalom. We find those having interest in their father's Pilegesh, and that's why I have to stress Pilegesh. But over here, Reuven may actually be doing something else as well. Which the Ramban accuses him of actually having a financial consideration in all of this. You can decide if you like that. In source, let's go in order. First source 19. Well, if you want 18 is Rashi, and Rashi has the cover-up. Source 17 is Rashi, and that's the cover-up. He only moved the beds. If you look at source 19, Vayelech Reuven, the Radak, Halach La'ol Bilha V'Shachav Imah. Wow, what a radical interpretation. Where does he get that from? From the Chumash. That's what it says. The Radak says that. That's what happened. Why? Reuven Chashav, the Radak continues and says, Ki lo haita asura, alav lefi shaita tchila shivcha v'chaklacha aviv lepilegesh. She's a pilegesh. So that's what he sees. He sees her as a pilegesh. If you then look at the Ramban, at the very towards the end of the Ramban, he writes that he was afraid that Yaakov would have more children, and therefore, as the Bechor, he stood to lose more. But I want to explain the Ramban, but actually extend it a little bit. If he's claiming that she's a Pilegesh, I think he's also claiming that the children of Pilegeshim will not inherit, which means that the estate of Yaakov will be divided into eight. I have to correct that in a second. Into eight, well, really into nine, but Reuven gets a double portion. On the other hand, if there are 12 children, then there's 13 portions, and he gets a double portion where it's more diluted. So over here, Reuven has financial incentive. See, the way that the Ramban played the financial incentive, he didn't want Yaakov to have more children. But I think a much simpler explanation, and this will also explain Yosef. Because what is it that Reuven did? Reuven claims that he's the firstborn, and there are only, in fact, eight brothers. That's all that there is, and he's the firstborn, and the other four can go away. Right? Avram's children of Pilegeshim got sent away. These can get sent away as well. He is, by doing this, not only... Meaning, is this really... We don't even know if it was a rape or not. And that is of less concern to me right now in terms of the interpretation, because we don't know what Bilha's thinking, we don't know any of that. But what we do, how do her children feel? Which means the way their children, that Reuven is just treating her as property. I mean, that's the problem. Which means when we see that there's a claim that the children of Bilha and Zilpah are being treated as if they are less than equals, the one who I see doing that is Reuven. Now, what I want to go back and then ask my question, so why isn't Reuven involved in protecting Dina? Reuven seems to be far more concerned with protecting himself. Which means Reuven's concerns are far more about himself and not about siblings the way that it should be. And I want to then go back and look at Shimon and Levi. Shimon and Levi, even though we can absolutely critique what they did, how they did it, what means they took, and what the results were, they feel kinship and they feel this sense of brotherhood and responsibility when they do it. And that's why the word their sister kept coming out on this. And again, I have a disappointment that Reuven and Yehuda were not involved in this. Yehuda, it seems, doesn't have this sense of kinship, and Reuven seems to have this self-centered aspect as well. Okay. Now, let's go back and think about Yosef. Because what is it that Yosef did? And I had always gotten fooled by this Nar et b'nei Bilha b'nei Zilpa, that at this point Yosef is very immature, and Yosef is very immature, so Yosef will make a great deal of mistakes because he's very immature. But there's certain things that we know about Yosef, and certain character traits don't change, which means Yosef is always a long-term thinker. Yosef is not somebody that just does something and has no clue whatsoever what's going to be the counter move. Yosef sees steps and steps in advance. Again, it's not a coincidence that Yosef's able to walk in, listen to the dreams, and say, okay, I'm going to give you now a 14-year economic plan for the country. He sees the future. And his dreams, he sees the future. He understands how things are going to work out. So Yosef is not a fool. Quite the opposite. Yosef knows exactly what Reuven did. Reuven is pushing these out the door. So what does Yosef do? He opens the door and pulls them back in. So he's counteracting Reuven over here, which actually, I mean, I hope that you see, takes a great deal of courage, because again, it's really one against one or one against six, perhaps. Binyamin, we're not going to count, which really then leads these Bnei Plaction, but I'm going to come back to them in a moment. So Yosef over here, he does something interesting, and that is that he pulls them closer. Now, there's a price to be paid for this. Now, the only question is, does he realize the price or does he not realize the price? I'd prefer to think that he does realize the price. But let's just do the math for a second. We learn in the beginning of Vayeshev that there is actually a hierarchy in the family. And who's at the top of the hierarchy? Yosef is at the top. Eilat Toldot Yaakov, Yosef. He's at the top. So what does he then do? He then says to the weakest, come, you're equals. But by saying that they're equals, he's not saying they're equal to him, because they're not equal to him. Who are they equal to? You're equal to the other brothers. Now, is this going to bring more love towards Yosef from the children of Leah? Because quite the opposite. Quite the opposite. Because what does he do? He is actually, they're going to pay the price for him saying, no, all of you are equal. And that's really what his dream is. Now go back and think about his dream. There are 11 stars in that dream. 11 are all equal. He turns to all of them. You're all equal, but you're all inferior. Now by saying you're all inferior, that can infuriate. So we have to be careful there. And of course, does Yosef know this? Of course Yosef knows this. I mean, does Yosef dream? Of course, everyone's going to accept me and so on. But Yosef is forcing this. He's, again, the only thing perhaps that I've added today is that he's counteracting Reuven, although he's actually helping Reuven, and I have to come back to that in a moment. Because he's saying all of you are equal. But I have to go back because it was very possible that immediately after Reuven does what he does, that Yaakov should have showed him the door. Which means Yaakov's response is remarkable. And I need to go back and to read that pasuk which spoke about the action of Reuven, because what was the rest of the pasuk? Again, source number 8, source page 2, source 8, Vayelech Reuven, Vayishkav et Bila, Pilegish Aviv, and that's why the Pilegish is bolded, Vayishma Yisrael, Vayihi B'nei Yaakov Shneimasar. Yaakov says, I have 12 children. What does Yaakov not do? He doesn't show him the door. Which means that continuation over here, and that's on a personal level, because you could have maybe said, oh, on a national level, Yisrael has 12 children, 12 tribes. No. Yaakov says, that's not the way that we have a family. This is really important, because again, I could take this out of this particular context. I mean, look at source 11 just for a moment. The Psikta says, why does it say that there are 12? Kedei le'achaz et Reuven emshar b'nei Yaakov, to tell you that there are 12. Look at source 12 now. He writes, the Medrash writes, Pilegish aviv v'shma Yisrael, Shema masha asa Reuven, kavash ka'aso v'lo kililo, lo lo v'lo zaro kemosha asa Noach. Noach has a son who does something which is outrageous, and Noach curses him. And Yaakov refuses to behave that way. At the end of this source, it says, right, Lamad Shafilu Bishat Kil Kolo, Ein Yusum Tchila El LeRuven Sharei Hiskir Cheto, V'Samach Oyu B'nei Yaakov Shneimasar Shakulam Ksherim. Now, it's easier to say Kulam Ksherim is if you whitewash what Reuven did, but if you don't whitewash what Reuven did, then the response of Yaakov is even stronger, and I would say more important. So now, if we think about it, what should have happened? He should have shown him the door. He should have kicked him out. Take a look at source 20, the Ramban, the beginning of that Ramban now, Vayishma Yisrael, Sipur HaKotuv Anvunato. It talks about his modesty. Kishama b'chalal b'no yitzuav, v'lot siva shiyatsuhu mi beito. Michlal banav v'lo yinachili mahem. He didn't say, kick him out of the house, and he's not going to inherit me, and he will not be included in my children. Avol yimna imahem, v'yushne masar, v'hu yimna rishon. He is still my son, he is still Reuven, and I'm still going to count him first, even though there are repercussions. There will be repercussions, but there, you know, the best repercussion is kick him out. And Yaakov doesn't do this. Now, this is incredibly important, which means that Yaakov just gave a message. That was the Ramban in source 20. Now, this is incredibly important. Again, I'll just speak outside for a second. In today's world, religious homes, there very often could be a child who doesn't live up to the same standards as the others, and in any way, shape, or form that you like. And the easiest thing to do for parents sometimes, especially the more religious, I would say, is say, no, you can't stay, and the concern is you're going to corrupt the others, or the concern is going to be you're going to hurt shiduchim, or whatever else the imagined or real concerns are going to be. Yaakov has a family, which is a complex family, where he has kids who are guilty of all kinds of very interesting things, and Yaakov absolutely refuses to kick out Reuven or kick out Shimon and Levi. He absolutely does. He goes, no, I have 12 children. These are my sons, and he doesn't kick anyone out, which means Yaakov gives a very important lesson, and that lesson is brothers are brothers, children are children. Take responsibility. There are times that you need to say things. There are times that you need to rebuke, but family is family, which means if you really understand what just now happened, and I do believe, by the way, and this I said a couple of weeks ago, I do believe this is also the way that Yaakov treated Esav. I think that there was love between Yaakov and Esav, and I don't believe there was rejection of Esav. At some point, there became a fear of Esav, but I think he was trying to cover up for Esav initially, and that's why he took the responsibility of the birthright. But what's important now to realize is that Yosef, Eila toldot Yaakov Yosef, the one who internalized the most Yaakov's value, that brothers are brothers, family is family, and you don't kick anybody out, is Yosef. And therefore, when Yosef has his dream, there are 11 stars, including Reuven, including Shimon, including Levi, including the Dan, right? Including the children of Bilhah and Zilpah. All of these are brothers. And where does he get this from? He gets this from Yaakov. Right. This is out of love, and when they don't behave properly, he tells Yaakov, because they are brothers, and Yaakov has to educate them, and he has to rebuke them. This is coming from love, and this is exactly what Yaakov asks. Let me know what's going on, because there's an understanding between them. It's because they're brothers. So let me try to complete this, or we won't get anywhere. When we get to the point, go back to source number one then, we get to the point... Yaakov sends Yosef on the mission, and he says, tell me how the others are doing. And why? Because these are all of his children. Yosef then goes, and he heads to Shechem. So, of course, we're back in the beginning, and Shechem is a scary place, and bad things happen, although good things also happen there. The only problem was they weren't in Shechem anymore. They had since moved on to Dothan. He gets lost. Vayimtza'ehu ish. Yaakov had his anonymous ish in last week's portion, and Yosef has his anonymous ish in this week's portion. Vayimtza'ehu ish. Vinei toa besada. And he's lost. Vayishaleo ish lomar matevakesh. And I think the word bikush is a really strong word. What is tevakesh? What does it mean? It's actually, what do you seek? What is your desire? What are you really looking for? And then Yosef says something which I think is the truest statement that he ever says, not that he's untruthful in other places, but this is the core of his being. Vayomer et achai enochi mivakesh. I'm looking for my brothers. This is not just where did my brothers go. This is who Yosef is. This is what he's doing. He's looking after his brothers because these are all his brothers. He's looking after them because his father asked him to, which means the whole dysfunctionality of the relationship that we read in the very beginning, or we take it that way, is Yosef is acting because Yaakov asks him to. And Yosef is really the one who's going to lead. And leadership means that if people make mistakes, it needs to be understood. He asks, where are they? And the man says they went to Dotan, Vayelach Yosef Acher Echav, and he goes looking for his brothers. Again, Yosef seeks his brothers. V'yimtzeru b'Dotan, he finds them. V'yuro tomi rechok, and they see him from afar. Uv'terem yikarev aleim v'naklua to olamito. But on the other hand, they see him from afar, and before he even gets there, they start to conspire to kill him. Now something's happening here, which you don't note. We never note. But something just now happened. And it's the resolution of what I've been talking about the whole time today, but you still don't know what I'm talking about, so let me explain. As soon as they say, let's kill him, so who is this? Vayimur ish el achiv. So most likely it is Shimon and Levi. You know, once you solve your problems based upon violence, it becomes a very easy way of resolving things. We're actually going to have, if we're right, and Rashi does say that this is Shimon and Levi, we're going to have our four B'nai Leah all speak in this scene. Shimon and Levi, their resolution is, kill him, right? So let's pause for a second. Why? Because the dreamer is here, and the whole plan is worked out. We'll kill him, we'll throw him into one of the pits, and we'll say a wild animal eat him, and we'll see what will be of their dreams. Now, they did something which you don't realize yet, so we have to build up a little more suspense. Reuven hears this, and Reuven then says, Vayishma Reuven vaytzilei miyadam, and he saves him from being murdered on the spot. Vayom alona kenu nafesh, no, let's not kill anyone. But he says, let's throw him into a pit. And what did he want to happen? Or what was, not want, what was it that he suggested? His suggested is, let's not kill him, it's very messy, let's throw him into a pit where he'll die naturally. It's a little cleaner. What does he say? Vayom alem Reuven, al tishpachu dam, don't spill blood, yishlichot el abor, hazeh asha ben midbar. Throw him into the pit, and then he'll die in the pit. V'yad al tushlechubo, let no one touch him. Laman, now we're told his intention, hitzil tomi adam l'shivo el aviv. Now, has Reuven suddenly developed kinship or brotherhood, or is this appreciation? Because Yosef's dream included him as an equal. Which means Reuven's status is very questionable right now. And who's the one who has shown him brotherhood? It has been Yosef. And has this somehow impacted Reuven's thinking? And Reuven obviously doesn't go far enough and doesn't do it the way that he should. They rip off the coat, which is the symbol of Yosef's leadership. And they throw him into the pit. And they sit down to eat. Now what was Yosef doing at this time? He was screaming. How do we know this? Because later on it says it. Later on it says, they said, why has all this evil come upon us when this strange man in Egypt wants to arrest them and do all kinds of terrible things to them? So they say, this has happened to us because we heard our brother's cries and we ignored it. Which means they're sitting and eating and Yosef is screaming in the pit and they ignore it. And then something happens. V'inei oracha Yishmaelim ba'a migilad. And then this caravan of Yishmaelim come by. Vayom Yehuda el Echav. Then Yehuda says something which is completely preposterous to his brothers, El Echav. Now notice something. Who is he speaking to? He's speaking to Echav. So who's included in Echav? So at this point, I would argue that who's included? Well, there are either 9 or 10 of them are included. Reuven is very interesting what happens to him. So we'll leave Reuven. But it sounds like he's speaking to the other 9. Now notice something. If it's the other 9, it includes B'nai Bil and B'nai Zilpa. But of course it includes them. Because Yosef's dream of including all of his brothers comes true in the most ironic way. The moment Shimon and Levi say, let's kill him, let's kill him, B'nai Bil and B'nai Zilpa have a problem. Well, they have a moral problem. A moral problem is, how can you go and kill an innocent person? They have another problem, is that Yosef is the one who's been protecting them. But the moment that Shimon and Levi say, let's kill them, do you realize what just now happened to B'nai Bil and B'nai Zilpa? They became one of the gang. They were just now included. For the old divisions just now disappeared. And they're looking back and forth because they're involved in this conspiracy. And if they're involved in this conspiracy, they're one of them. Which means Shimon and Levi are solving a problem the way they wanted to solve it. The others are watching this, and essentially they make a terrible political deal. I say it's terrible. For them, it was a wonderful deal. But they make a terrible political decision. And what's that decision? We will turn our backs on the person who protected us, on the person who looked out for us. We're going to turn our backs on Yosef because we're going to lose one protector. But what are we going to gain at the same time? We're going to gain another six. We just now became part of the children of Leah, of the Yaakov family. They were just now welcomed into the family in the worst possible way because they're conspirators and they're part of a terrible secret, and that terrible secret will either be the murder or the sale of Yosef. So Yosef's, I said before, Yosef, when he had the dream, 11 of you, Yosef was pushing them towards this. I'm not saying and I'm not claiming that Yosef knew necessarily that the sale would take place, but Yosef was putting all of them in the same situation in order to get them to the point that they're all united. And when he tells the dream, I'm going to be above all of you, he is forcing them all to become one group. Which means it's Yosef's manipulation that brings all the others together, and he forces B'nai Leah to accept B'nai Bil and B'nai Zilpah to become equals. And that's what Yosef's goal was over here. He accomplished it. There was what I think we can call unintended consequences of his plan, and that is that he ends up in a caravan going off on the way to Egypt. But my point, what I was really trying to get to today, is that Yosef is really clever, and Yosef being really clever, it wasn't just that he tells the dream or tells the story or treats them as just as this independent action having nothing to do with the larger plan which is taking place. He has a plan and he accomplishes it. So again, that's what's ironic. Yosef brings them together. The other thing which is really interesting, and this is a point I've made before, is remember before I mentioned Yehuda, he misses all of God's signs. You know, the son dies and his wife dies and whatever, and instead of ever taking responsibility, listen to what Yehuda says. Yehuda looks up, he sees the caravan go by, or going by. What are we going to gain by killing our brother and then covering it up? Let's go and sell him to the Ishmaelim. And it says, why? V'yodeinu al tehibo, and let our hands not be involved. And this, by the way, it's already true by throwing in the pit. In the pit. But then he says, why? Ki achenu ubisareinu hu, because after all, he's our brother. And you read this and you say, are you out of your mind? Which means if he would have left that part out, then he could have sold me. You're our brother. And then v'yishmur echav, and his brothers listen. And I'll say it again. They're all united right now. And the next pasuk is Vayavru Anashim Midyanim Socharim. And then Midyanim go by. So what happened to Yehuda? Yehuda had a sign. He had a sign from God. Many years ago, Avram had two sons. And Avram loved both of his sons and he wanted to create one family. And Sarah said, no, you got to get rid of one of them. He can't stay with my son. And God says, listen to her. And that woman, of course, was Sarah Imenu. And over here, they have a problem. What is their problem? They have a problem. What do we do with this Yosef? And then God gave him a sign. Yishmaelim came by. Sarah Imenu from Gan Eden is telling Yehuda exactly what to do. This is how you solve your problem. Do what Avram did with Yishmael. Send him away. And who comes by a second later? Midian. Who's Midian? Midian is the son of Keturah, whose father was Avram, son of the Pelegish, who Avram sent away. This is a sign from heaven. Which means Yehuda sees signs. Well, my only point is it's a little dangerous to see signs when the signs tell you what you want them to tell you. The signs that God really gave Yehuda, those he didn't hear. The only sign that he ever ended up hearing is when Tamar spoke to him in very, very clear terms. And at that point, Yehuda turns around. And at that point, Yehuda very unexpectedly suddenly emerges as the other candidate to be involved in this last third of Bereshit. Which means Yosef is clearly the hero over here, and Yosef is the one who's outthinking everybody. He may have outthought himself here as well. Yosef absolutely accomplished his goal, because as I said, if we just set up what the real issue was over here, the real issue was the status of the Pilagshim, of the children of the Pilagshim. Reuven is the one who has this gambit, and he says, I will take this Pilegish, and therefore by pushing the other children out the door, the one who responds to him, Yaakov is silent, and Yaakov, I have 12 kids. Family is family. I'm not kicking him out. Yosef inherits this family is family, but we need to create this feeling that everyone knows they're a family and there are these vulnerable people. I mean, think about the rest of Yosef's life. He always knows. He knows how to deal with vulnerable people. And it's not because he himself has been vulnerable, because Yosef has so much confidence, but he knows how to take care of others. And that's what he always does. Yosef over here realizes that these people, the son of the Pilgrim, need to be taken care of, and he will. He will create them as equals. So what he does is a beautiful strategy by tells them all about the dream that he has, all 11 of you. And each one may hear it differently. Reuven, wow, I'm included. Shimon and Levi are still included. But the children of the Pilgrim are still included. And all of them have a common enemy, and that common enemy is Yosef. And they act against him. And when they do, and maybe he doesn't anticipate how strong it's going to be, but when they do, they now have broken down all the boundaries, and we never hear again any issues about Pilgrim, B'nai Pilgrim. From this point on, Yaakov truly has 12 children.